penultimate of the panels for the Responsible Tourism Programme this year at WTM. And what I wanted to do with this panel is to look at the question of why so many people who don't work in the industry, and many of those who do, regard it as a rather poor employer in terms of both remuneration and the terms and conditions of employment. It's an issue which we've tried to talk about on several occasions within the Responsible Tourism Programme, but surely getting decent working conditions for the people who work in the industry ought to be a key part of what we're about. So we have a panel of six people. We're having no PowerPoints in this session at all in order to maximise the amount of time for question and answers. What I propose to do is to ask each of our panellists to say a little bit about why they do and why they're on the panel. I'm going to go to Kevin Curran last, because what he has to say will then set the agenda for the rest of the session. So everybody gets one nice, soft, easy question. After that, you're all going to be responding essentially to what Kevin is saying from the point of view of the employees in the industry. So Patrick, let's start with you. Fresh from getting a silver award in the World Responsible Tourism Awards, so I guess that implies that we quite like what you do. Do you want to say something about what you do and why you do it that way?
Certainly. I've got a holiday park down in Cornwall, and we employ around 25 people. And in 2013, we made the move towards living wage accreditation. Some of you may know that this week is Living Wage Week in the UK, and it is desperately sad that there is so much in-work poverty, and I'm sure Kevin will have quite a lot to say on that. But we, as a business, we're a very profitable business in Cornwall, and we took the view that we wanted to treat our staff as we would wish to be treated ourselves in a profitable business. So we took the leap, and we pay the real living wage. Putting that in context, the real living wage was announced on Monday. It's £9 an hour now. And compared to that, the national living wage, which is the minimum wage for over 25s, is £8.21. So that's a little bit about Mother Ivy's Bay. Harold, are you happy with that?
Not really.
Okay.
Patrick, you seem to be implying that you'd only done it because you were profitable.
Ah, no.
And I don't believe that to be the case. I don't think you're speaking the truth there.
No, you're absolutely right. I am also involved with the food bank movement. I'm a trustee of my local food bank, and I do actually take a personal interest in what goes on with our local community. And where I'm based in Cornwall, there is a lot of poverty. Cornwall is actually a byword for low pay. And it certainly, as far as hospitality is concerned, it shouldn't be, in my opinion, because we are a premium brand. People like Cornwall. They want to come to Cornwall. And therefore, there is added value that businesses have. And it is about sharing that with the whole community so that as a business, we are benefiting our local community.
Thanks, and if Howard. I asked you what the business case is, if you're talking to another owner of a caravan park, what's the business case if they're not interested in the ethics?
Harold's drawing teeth here. Sorry about that. I'm making it difficult for you.
You are.
Certainly, as far as the business case goes, there is clearly a cost to paying the higher real living wage. In my business, that's about £40,000 that my shareholders are not getting and my staff are receiving. In return for that £40,000, which initially we did altruistically, but in return for that, we are getting a stable workforce. We are getting we're finding it far easier to recruit staff, and we're getting the pick of the team, so we're getting very good staff, a quality team. We are retaining them. We spend quite a lot of money on training, and in the past, my staff used to leave and then they'd go somewhere else for a few pence an hour more. So I would have spent the money on training and I'd have lost the team. Now we're getting the benefit of that. It feeds through to productivity. productivity and service is quite difficult to get your head around. But basically, we've got an enhanced guest experience, which means that our guests are booking again with us. They're repeat booking and they're recommending us to their friends. Our levels of repeat bookings and recommendations are way above industry norms. That feeds through to occupancy itself. If I tell you that my hire fleet of 60 caravans is 90% occupancy, that's unheard of in the industry. In fact, in hotels, you outside of the best hotels in central London, you don't expect to get 90%. It's absolutely fantastic. It's all down to my team. And so paradoxically, the business case is we treat our wages as an investment rather than a cost. And paradoxically, we're making more money because we're doing that. So it's a win-win, and it's good for the team, it's good for my shareholders, and it's good for the local community.
Thank you, Patrick. Kevin, I noticed you were nodding your head a lot there, but I'm going to come back to you in a bit. Let's go on to LV from The Good Hotel.
Hi, hello everyone. So my name is LV. I'm a general manager of Good Hotel London. We're based just about 200 yards that way in the Royal Victoria Dock. So we are slightly different to most other hotels, and there's probably three extinct areas where we're different. One, we are profit for non-profits, which quite simply means that all the money we make, all the profits we make, we reinvest into good causes, NGOs in our case, in London specifically. Second is we've got a quite unique training program where we work with our local Newham Council. We try to train about 20 people each and every quarter. These are the people that didn't have jobs before for various reasons. So that's where we go to the local council. They find these people and we try to show them the way in hospitality, in the sense that we give them skills, we give them experience, and in a lot of cases confidence to continue working in this great industry of ours. And the third very different aspect about our hotel is we are floating hotel. So we're literally sitting on water. It was built in Netherlands about a decade ago. We bought it, we converted into a hotel, and yeah, here we are.
James, so do you want to tell us something about employment in your business?
So we exclusively take the trainees that I mentioned from Newham Borough Council, which is local to us. We are here and we will continue working with Newham. We feel it's extremely important for us to be part of the community, whether it's, you know, locally here within 300 metres or bigger borough. Newham is very perceptive to these things, so it helps us a lot that we've got a huge amount of support from the council. And that's basically the idea. Take people that don't have jobs, train them up, give them confidence, and then make sure they have sustainability in their lives in the long term.
Thanks very much indeed. Madhu, can we come to you and the International Tourism Partnership in your hotels?
Sure. I'm Madhu. I'm the new director of the International Tourism Partnership. My background is in hotels. I've spent 10 years working for major hotel companies like Hilton, Marriott, Starwood, and also for Emirates Airlines. And I've spent the last 10 years working in the not-for-profit sector, looking at a whole range of issues from youth employment to women's empowerment, to girls' education, human rights, etc. So I'm here on behalf of ITP, which basically is a membership organization, working with about 15 hotel companies all over the world, representing 15% of the industry, and looking at galvanizing action around four key goals: water, carbon, human rights, and youth employment. So looking forward to sharing some of our work.
Okay, can we focus, Maddie, can we focus on the employment question?
Sure.
How many of the of your hotels actually employ the housekeepers?
Sorry,
In your hotels, in all those ITP companies, How many of them directly employ the housekeepers, for example?
I won't be able to share how many actually directly employ housekeepers, but obviously everyone uses housekeepers, whether that's through direct employment or through subcontracting as part of the labour procurement.
I mean, I asked the question because I think the issue of subcontracting is one we're going to have to come back to, because
sure,
it's becoming a prevalent model in the industry, and I think we need to come back and discuss that. I'm sure Kevin will raise it. Can we come now to Intrepid? Thanks for coming along. I was worrying that I was going to have to blow your company's trumpet for you. Intrepid have just won gold in the Responsible Tourism Awards. Do you want to explain why?
Sure. We won gold in the Responsible Tourism Awards for best employment for an initiative in Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka is an important part of our business, a growing market, and we were recognised for the way in which we're remunerating our tour leaders and also our staff in region. The average tour leader is paid quite a low wage set by the regulation board in Sri Lanka. And we took the decision to pay a fair bit more than the minimum wage. And I suppose the reason we did that is because fundamentally as a tour operator or travel company, our skill set and experience is our people. And so we needed to attract and reward the best people in the best possible way. And we've also introduced initiatives like annual bonus structures for the tour leaders, which isn't something that happens in Sri Lanka. And in fact, the regulators were quite unhappy that we wanted to initiate an annual reward scheme for the tour leaders, but we managed to work collectively with them, and they accepted our proposal, and so we've been able to reward the tour leaders far better than that which they would otherwise have got. So really, really pleased to be honoured.
So if there was another tour operator here, James, and they said, why on earth are you doing that? You're depriving your shareholders. What would your answer be to that?
Oh, I completely disagree. We're depriving our shareholders. I think our shareholders are getting a better return because we're providing a better experience because we've got better talented people on the ground, and that better experience translates through to more customers wanting to travel with us and a higher repeat and referral score, and that helps grow our overall global revenue. And if we're growing our overall global revenue and managing our business properly, we'll get a better profitable outcome. So I fundamentally believe, Harold, that purpose initiatives do not have to be at the expense of profit initiatives. Far from it. We've been, I think, hopefully quite purpose-led and great to be recognised for two awards today. But we've also been profitable. And we've had some of our best profitable years.
What, you will know offhand what your repeat rate is, won't you?
Yep, so 27%.
Okay, thanks very much, James. And I'm delighted to have two winners here on the panel with me. Andreas, before I go to Kevin...
Okay.
So Andreas is an academic, he can't help it. He's a very nice academic and a very good one. Do you want to just set a bit of context on this?
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, good afternoon, everybody. So I work at Plymouth University, and I've been researching issues around employment in tourism for quite a few years now. And one thing that led me to have this research focus, really, is that in my view, the debates around responsible and sustainable tourism haven't focused sufficiently on the employment dimension. That's not to detract from the importance of the environmental aspect. Clearly, that's critical too. So it's not a case of saying the environmental is not important or less important, but I really feel that the employee, as the kind of immediate stakeholder of the organisation, needs to have more of a voice, and more focus needs to be on the employee in discussions around sustainable and responsible tourism. So thank you for inviting me, Harold, and it's great to be part of this discussion. Thank you.
So which are the good examples that we haven't got here talking today?
Okay. There are always some good examples, and you know, some of them, some of you are here today. There are examples in my research from Canada, organizations that, for example, in the recruitment process, typically it's very informal in the tourism and hospitality industry. With the example of two hotels in Canada, there's about four senior managers, interview every new recruit to really make sure they fit the organization. But then they support that, all the employees too, to really provide the best career opportunities, meeting the needs of that individual. So there are really good examples out there. And I think one way of convincing industry is to provide them with the examples. And that's coming from an academic. I'm not saying give everybody all the theory and they'll kind of read it and believe it and change. If you want change, people need to see it, it being realised, how it happens in practice. And so it's great to see some representatives here today.
Just before we go to Kevin, one of the things I've been trying to get research done on in the travel and tourism industry for the last 10 years, completely unsuccessfully, is progression.
Yep.
Because I still think that travel and tourism is one of the sectors which is relatively open. And you would see that in Intrepid. Many people join as a tour leader and they move on up through the structure. But we still have never managed to get out a piece of work that demonstrates that it is that. And therefore, it poses the question, am I mistaken or is it genuinely open for progression?
Yeah.
Andreas first, and then I'll come back to you, James, and then we're going to go to Kevin.
Yeah. Interestingly, it's one of those paradoxes in tourism employment that, you know, on the one hand, we have people saying that it's a dead-end career, it's low-skill, low-paid, you know, it's just a temporary thing until people find a proper job. On the other hand, there are examples, and it is true, that career progression can be far more rapid, people can rise more rapidly than in many other industries. So it's a complicated issue. It's, you know, it's not a straightforward black and white issue at all. And I think more research should be done. Unfortunately, in my experience, when you try to speak to some employers about employment issues, there can be a reluctance to engage. So if there are any employers out there willing to engage in research, come and speak to me because I'd like to do some more research in that area.
So you would do research on progression if we could get the detail for
absolutely,
you?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, well, there's the challenge going out from WTM today. James, do you want to just a brief comment? And I do want to go to Kevin.
We're happy to be the company that does the research, so that would be good. I started as a business development manager with Intrepid in 2005. I'm now the CEO of the global company, so it's a good example of progression from someone who started right at the entry level and has worked my way through the organization over the last 13 years. At the back there, we've got Gary Cohen. He was a tour leader for us in Latin America. He's now our regional general manager for Latin America. Zina Benchik, who's been on a couple of panels here, was our finance manager. She's now our regional general manager for the whole of Europe, Middle East, and Morocco. So there's a wide range of examples where, as a business can grow and do it in a purpose-led environment, lots and lots of opportunities for people to develop internally. So it's, yeah, a number of examples with Intrepid. And we'd love to do some research with you.
Sorry, if I could just come into that, Harold. My first day on the job in the hotel industry, I started in housekeeping. And I remember cleaning dozens and dozens of toilets and making a lot of beds in the industry. And I can vouch for what the industry did for my career, as well as for a lot of colleagues who began in similar sort of roles and have gone on to progress to be general managers and even more senior levels. And we'd be very delighted for some of our member companies to work with you on the research as well. So,
Andreas, please write that down.
It's all stored.
Good. Okay, Kevin, let's come back to the downside of this. We've looked at some of the positives. Low wages and long hours, casual and seasonal work patterns, often now zero-hour contracts, a lot of outsourcing of contracting, and some debt bondage, undoubtedly, in the sector. Not the great stuff that we would want to talk about. I've also put up the slide of the Marriott strike, which I think is still going on.
Which one, sorry?
Marriott.
Yeah.
The Marriott strike, I think, is still going on. Do you want to just give your perspective from as a trade unionist of why where the sector is at and why the sector is there and not in a better place?
Right, thanks, Samuel. Thanks very much for the invitation to talk to one today. I didn't expect to be bookended by two of the saints of the industry, though, so all credit to them. And all those who are doing the positive things that people have talked about, we're not here to criticise progress. I'm here to constructively criticise what's not happening. My experience is organising hotel workers in central London over the last 14 years, and that means mostly housekeepers, chefs, waiters, porters, kitchen staff, housekeepers, the kind of backroom staff that are usually mostly invisible, but also mostly not employed either by the brand or the hotel they work in. Normally employed by an agency on minimum wage, the minimum wage, and also, mostly in London again, migrant labour from all over the world. Just the last 10 years, seen a very big influx of workers from Eastern Europe. And a lot of those workers have got low educational achievement, are fairly unskilled, and they see an entry-level job in London, and obviously they take it. So the industry is very good at providing entry-level jobs. The problem we've got is a lot of those entry-level jobs are essentially dead-end jobs. There is no progression beyond that point. Now, there'll be some exceptions to that, granted, but the overall experience is you start there and you stay there. You don't develop. Now, there's a lot of barriers there. One is that the structure of the industry is such now that we moved away 25 years ago from owning and running a hotel to being a brand that's sold to a management company and goes to find a hotel that someone else owns that you put the brand in. In other words, most of the people I represent are not employed by the hotel they work in. They're employed by an agency. So a lot of the big brands say, sorry, pal, not our problem. You know, they don't work for us. And then they go on to make those agencies compete for the contracts year on year. So housekeeping contracts come up year on year. And so the bidder is going to be successful there. It's got to undercut the contractors presently got the job. So you're driving everything down to the bottom all the time. Now, that precludes any training budget for a start. That's out straight away. Even if subcontracted employers are even going to think about training. But for those employers in the industry who do want to train people, who are genuine about it, they face some barriers as well because, as I say, a lot of the workers that I represent lack confidence, they lack self-esteem, because a lot of the environments they work in are environments where they're bullied and harassed. The low educational achievement, English, they may have some English, they generally speaking they don't have. So we as a union have offered the industry sit-down talks, talk about how we can address this. So we've been doing this for the last 14 years. We've yet to have a response, by the way. But the key challenge for us is how we get those workers into education and training. And part of that process is providing in-house training on the job in work hours. A lot of these workers have got long travel to work journeys. A lot of them are physically exhausted. A lot of them are not going to do something extra in the evening other than go home and rest. So we need to be very inventive about how we don't just offer opportunity, but how we also offer access to opportunity. And that's the challenge. Now, it's very rewarding to hear what Patrick had to say, because I was always also a living wage campaigner years ago. And when KPMG first got involved, and KPMG is a major British international accountancy and management company, and they were persuaded to take their cleaners in-house years ago. And their experience is exactly the same as Patrick's and exactly the same as every other living wage employer. So there's got to be a business case there as well as a case for decency at work. And there's got to be an opportunity for the employers to sit down with our union. We provide, with the TUC, education and training through our training reps and through our training centres. And we provide that, you know, as part of our service to our members. So we can sit down and talk about English as a first language. We can talk about computer skills. We can talk about getting people above the base level so that the industry can then say, yeah, well, we've got potential here. Because when I hear the industry talk about their worry about scarcity of jobs or scarcity of employees, I think they're genuinely concerned. I think they have a right to be. I think post-Brexit, whatever happens, and also the value of the pound against the euro is going to have an impact on the labour market. And only those employers savvy enough to invest in their workforce are going to get that benefit, because I had an experience of 5 months ago where 20 workers left one hotel for 5p an hour to go to another hotel. Now, so that's already started. Now, if we want an industry to be successful, and we all do, then we've got to really address the whole question of training and development seriously. The industry doesn't have a problem with the workforce. It's already there. Well, the problem they've got is they don't know how to access, train and develop it, or they're blind to the fact that that's just what they should be doing. That potential is sitting there already. And our challenge, I think, is to open that potential up. So though all those points that Harold made on the board there, they're all true. It's all those things that create work which isn't decent, which isn't attractive, which is the complete opposite. We're finding some of our members now gravitating towards retail. They'd rather go and work for Amazon than work in a hotel. So the warning signs are there, Harold, and I think there's a debate to be had. But clearly there's a tremendous opportunity as well.
I mean, it must be true, mustn't it? I think probably undeniably true, that if you turn your employees into a simple commodity that you're buying at the cheapest possible price, then the level of loyalty will be low, because
Absolutely.
They'll simply move to the next highest job that they can get, yeah, which is what happens with rice or coffee or anything else. So it doesn't make sense. But before I'm going to go, can I just ask who's going to control the mic in the room when I go for Q&A? Is there someone here to do that? Probably not. Okay. We will go to Q&A in a minute. But Kevin, just before we do, how much of the labour in those lower paid jobs in the hotels in London do you think is outsourced?
Outsourced? Well, the workers I mentioned, probably 90%. 90% of the workers I mentioned. Very few of them are directly employed.
And how many of them are working through a gang leader or gang master who organises that and may have organised their immigration?
It's quite informal, but at each what's happened, is that in hotels they've concentrated on trying to have one dominant ethnic group in the hotel, and then they appoint someone as the supervisor because the managers don't know what's going on. They don't understand the culture or the language. They wouldn't understand what's going on, and that person usually is more an overseer than a supervisor.
Now, I hear stories about people signing off and going back to finish their shift.
It's very common. I mean, the legislation in this country says that you've got to be paid the national minimum wage. So the way you get around in hotels is you're paid by the room unofficially. So if you're on the national minimum wage and you're asked to do 16 rooms a day, if you've only finished 12, you get signed off from work and get sent back to work. So effectively you're working outside for nothing. So you're working more hours than you should do. That's quite common practice.
Just to be clear on the legal position, if somebody was then to have an accident at work while they're working in that period when they're signed off, would they still be insured?
No, strictly speaking, they wouldn't, because the employer would say, look, he signed off, he shouldn't have been here.
Yeah.
And then that person, remember, has already signed a contract in English, which they don't understand at all, which excuses them from the working hours directive. And so essentially the rights have been signed away. They wouldn't be aware of it.
Okay, can we go to the audience? Is there anyone with a question? I'm led to believe there's somebody from the Living Wage Foundation here.
Hiya, I'm Sarah Johnson from the Living Wage Foundation. It's brilliant to hear about some of the initiatives that are already happening, and particularly hearing from Patrick about those benefits of being a living wage employer, the business benefits, and also the benefits for the wider community. And this week, as it's Living Wage Week, there are thousands of workers all around the UK that are celebrating being paid, getting a pay rise, by those 4,700 employers all around the UK. However, and particularly in the tourism industry, low pay is still a huge issue, and it's a huge issue to tackle. How do we tackle this issue, and how do we engage more employers in the industry to make commitments to tackling low pay and make commitments to becoming living wage employers? Thank you.
Patrick, can I come back to you? Because You clearly take very seriously the view that you get a better business because you pay your staff more.
That sounds without doubt. Yeah. Same as that gentleman.
Does that apply across all the grades of employment in your... Does that apply to the people who clean the toilets?
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Why?
Because everybody engages with the customers on my park. My starting point is, you're not just a cleaner, you are a cleaner. You're actually the person who carries the business. You're doing the most important jobs. Nobody wants to go to my toilet blocks. And indeed, if you look on my Twitter feed, not my Twitter feed, my TripAdvisor feed, you'll see where we've got it wrong, and people, they're very quick to complain. It's not a perfect 5-star TripAdvisor review, unfortunately. It's not bad, but it's not as good as it could be. But we get the team to take ownership of customers. So my staff, and I can't employ people who can't speak English because I want them to take ownership of customers, and my customers are almost all English speaking. And if you're within 12 feet of one of my staff are expected to look at you, smile, engage. That doesn't mean they're going to stop and talk to you. They will give you the opportunity to stop them. My gardener is one of the best people to talk to. He knows everything. He's a local. He knows everything about what's going on in the community. You want to know what's going on, you talk to him. So yes, I'm getting a great service because I've got a great team, and that's right from the bottom up.
So in theory, the growth of the experiential tourism experience should strengthen the decent employment conditions argument, shouldn't it? Because that's what they're getting from your gardener.
Oh, yeah.
That sense that they're going to have a local experience.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
So another question. Gentleman over here.
Yes, Mike Roberts. I'm involved in a number of areas. I'm also a senior councillor. My local authority, all its internal staff are on the real living wage. None of the people we have contracts with are verified with regard to what they pay. So we have a job to do on that side. If you look across the sectors, hospitality, the gig economy, tourism, and so it goes on, all have a big problem. And, you know, I know what Kevin is about, because I'm also a member of Unite as well, but the issues are bigger than just your ordinary contracts and your ordinary staff. We are talking about millions of people. Even the gig economy is about 4 to 5 million people alone, without tourism, local authorities and whatever. So there's an awful lot of work to be done and to get your head around and to actually make an effort to get involved with trying to verify. So, you know, that is the state and challenge before us.
Does anybody want to comment on that? I have tried to leaven this with some good optimistic stories as well.
Two specific questions. How has
Andy,
the modern slave...
Andy, can you say who you are first?
Yeah, sorry, Andy Rutherford from Fresh Eyes, People to People Travel. So, first question is, how has the Modern Slavery Act, which has got implications not just on people in formal employment, but also down to contractors, affected all of you on how you've organised and responded to workers' rights? And secondly, to Kevin, we're here in London. As everyone says 10th of the GDP of London is around travel and tourism. What is the current state of trade union organising within the tourism and travel industry, and how many collective bargaining agreements are there?
That's two questions, Andy. Yeah, let's take the modern slavery one first. The Australian government, I think, is still in the process of drafting, and it's still going through. I don't think it's yet through.
No, it's not through, no.
What do you think? It's not going to make much of a difference to you, clearly.
I don't think it'll make a material difference to us, no.
But in Australia more generally, do you think it will have a big impact?
I hope it has a big impact. I'm always a bit loath to talk about Australian politics as a Brit because
I think you're rather more of the employers.
The employers, yeah. Look, I hope it'll have an impact, but yeah, it's very hard for me to offer too much guidance or advice on it, to be honest, Aaron.
Well, we have got the Modern Slavery Act passed in Britain. Has it made much difference to the ITP members?
Yeah, so modern slavery is overarching, not just the Modern Slavery Act. It's one of the biggest focus areas of our work. And I'd like to say a few years back, ITP had engaged with Unite and done a stakeholder consultation workshop, and this came up as a big area of focus for us. And following on from that, earlier this summer, we have developed that piece of work to launch ITP's Principles of Forced Labour, which all our members have assigned to. And essentially, the principles say no one should have to pay for a job, everyone should have freedom of movement, and nobody should feel coerced to work. And that's as a basic starting point that all our members are starting to endorse. They comply with Modern Slavery Act and also look at local regulation levels. Building upon that, some of our members have gone as far as developing trainings for staff, some for all staff, but in the background for procurement staff, for the legal teams that are involved to drive that cultural change when they're working with subcontractors to make sure proper contracts are in place and mechanisms are placed to avoid modern slavery in the industry.
Madhu, I don't want to pick just on ITP. It's sure. Not just an ITP problem, but one of the things I'm going away from WTM with this year is a strong sense that I keep hearing about the guidelines. There's guidelines on this, there's guidelines on that, animal welfare, child protection, modern slavery, lots of guidelines. I'm beginning to wonder, though, how many of the guidelines are actually being complied with. Because in a way, the guidelines are the easy bit. It takes time to get them written. But what we're not hearing about is the level of compliance with the guidelines. Do you have a view, Madhu, about where ITP members are in terms of compliance with, let's just stick with the labour conditions. Mm-hmm.
So you're absolutely right. There are lots of guidelines in everything, in every sphere of life at the moment. And change is hard to drive, and it takes time and you know, to actually bear fruition. What I'm seeing with the ITP members in the industry is because of the level of practical action that's being taken, where I mentioned trainings earlier, some of our members are training all staff to be aware of human rights and modern slavery and recognize signs of it and drive it forward in their operations. That's a practical action, and ITP is working together with its member companies to identify some other practical areas of action and collaboration. For example, in Qatar, just last month, we had a roundtable on human rights issues, convened all the human resources directors across the table to look at what the level of compliance was and what more needs to be done, and that's a big area of work that we are driving forward. We're also beginning to look at internationally in source and destination markets and what more work can be done to support young people in source markets with their recruitment processes to drive practical action forward. We are looking at rehabilitation of survivors of trafficking in the industry, and also progression of young people that engage with us through our youth career initiative to rise beyond some of the entry-level positions. So there are lots of practical examples of good practice that are coming through. I'd say watch the space for more to come.
Are you optimistic? Are you personally optimistic, Madhu, that we are going to see progress in this area?
I'm very optimistic, Harold, and I say that also as a hotelier. I mean, you spoke about empowering staff and giving them pride and looking after them. I started my career in the hotel industry, and one of the biggest things that Marriott, as my employer, my first employer, used to say was make sure every member of the staff is empowered to look after the guests and do whatever it takes. And you know, they always, as a culture, Marriott believes in looking after its staff so they can look after their guests in return. So that's something that I've grown with. I've seen it in all team meetings, 3 times a day, you know, being emphasized by the general manager to every single level of the industry, whether you're employed staff or whether you're subcontracted staff. That's just the culture that I've seen myself and experienced.
One of the things that's always puzzled me, and I'm, you know, I've never been a major employer. I have employed one or two people at a time, but never a major employer. But if you're letting contracts every year for new employment with a new agency that's providing you with staff, and you keep driving down the price, there's no real efficiency to be got for that, because the contract is on a number of hours of input for a given amount of money. Surely there comes a point where the agent cannot be paying a living wage. Just mathematically, that must be true, mustn't it?
Well, that's why there's a whole body of work which is happening around how hotel companies engage with their recruitment supply chain and procurement of labour. Sorry, just say something.
Can we come to Mark, with a microphone?
Yeah, hello, yeah. Mark Watson, former Executive Director at Tourism Concern. I always think the industry makes this far more complicated than it needs to be. The very simple thing that employers could do, all hotels could do, is be accredited living wage employers. That would be a very good step, make a huge difference. One of the reasons, as a judge on the award, one of the reasons I liked Patrick's stuff is it's so easy and so replicable to do that. Just pay the London living wage or the living wage, and that would make a huge difference to people. So I wonder how many of your members are accredited living wage employers, and if they're not, why not, and what are you doing to get them to be that? Because I think that's very important. The other thing that made a huge difference, I think, to people's working conditions, and we did surveys in a number of hotels around the world, the biggest factor we found was whether they had good union representation. And I think that those two things alone make a huge difference to workers' rights: good union representations and paying the proper living wage.
And I agree with you. I mean, as a neutral intermediary, and I'll emphasize that ITP is a neutral intermediary, and that's why we listen to people like yourself, trade unions, what Kevin had to say from Unite a few years ago, and make sure we use that to feed that up to our members and drive change within the industry. There are some initiatives that have been taken, but there's a huge amount that's still to be done, and that's something that we'll continue to work with our members on.
Okay, so Madhu, at the risk of being tedious about it, so let's ask you one last question, and then we'll come to these two.
Sure.
How confident are you that your members would know whether they had actually got bonded, debt-bonded labour in their workforce?
It's complex, Harold. Just from my experiences of the industry and conversations with members, they are reliant on staff coming up and telling us or telling the members what they've experienced. There is no way of really knowing whether someone has paid a fee to a recruitment agency or not. And at the most grassroots level, and from my own time in the industry, staff members are invited to share that. There is an anonymous complaint box, experiences box, outside key parts of hotels where people are encouraged, I was encouraged, to share my views without any fear of being found out or being identified, and I've seen action being taken. So I think it's to each one of us, including the staff members who are feeling or are going through some grave difficulties, to actually come up and open up about it.
You have the microphone. Your question.
Hi, my name is Karen. I worked in the industry for about 17 years, and now I've become an academic. So I'm doing a bit of research at the moment. You've all been speaking about progression, workforce, keeping people, retaining people, and all the kind of, obviously, some good initiatives. I'd just like to ask you a question, which I'm doing a bit of a thesis on. How do we work out a sustainable workforce for the future? Not 5 years, not 10 years, but 20 to 50 years down the line. I'm looking at how do we make our industry more professional? Like when people are growing up and they're 5 years old and they want to become a doctor or a dentist, why is our industry not looked at the same? Because it's an amazing place to work, and they could be making the same amount of money, if not more, than doctors and lawyers, etc. And obviously, because from a global point of view, it's rising constantly within the whole of all the countries around us.
There was one other question over here somewhere. Can you take the microphone and ask your question?
Hi, Sean from Shiva Foundation. We work with hotels as well. We've been obviously talking a lot, particularly from Madhu here, about the hotels themselves. And Madhu works with corporate levels, so not even necessarily the owners. And so what I want to know, and potentially, Kevin, you can speak about this. Outsourcing is massive, as you yourself have identified. We're not going to turn that around anytime soon. Maybe this is the answer to your question. Maybe in 50 years there won't be as much outsourcing, but there are benefits to it aside from just low wage or whatever that might be, as everybody's thinking here. So if outsourcing is still happening, and we've agreed that at least we know with hotels that those working in the hotels who are employed by the hotels are being paid the real living wage or whatever, what work is being done with the labor suppliers and recruitment agents? And I'm thinking particularly with unionization.
What I would like to suggest, though, we're actually now out of time. So I'm going to ask each panelist to give one final answer, taking into account the two questions that have just been asked. But before they do that, let me say that one of the panels next year will be on the workforce of the future for travel and tourism. Because by then in the UK, I think it's going to be a really hot issue. And a lot of employers are going to have to change their behaviours, I think. But can we just go around? Can we start with you, James? If you could keep your answers brief, that would be great.
James. Sure. For a company like Intrepid, as a tour operator, people is our best and number one resource. So look after your people as best as you possibly can, and I guarantee that will create longevity within the workplace and therefore provide a better customer experience and therefore help grow your overall organisation. So look after and reward your best people as best as you can.
Madhu?
So I'll say there's a huge focus on retention in the industry, but I think the industry's role in equipping its staff with transferable skills that are valuable for career needs to be emphasized. And it needs to be, I think overall the industry needs to be positioned as an employer that can help build careers. So there's a marketing piece that we need to do to promote careers in the industry.
Andreas?
So I think things are getting better. Well, you know, the trend is positive, but you know, things aren't improving quickly enough. And I don't really believe any substantial changes will be achieved in the short term. I can't see it happening. So there is some optimism, but also a bit of pessimism thrown in there too, I'm afraid.
LV, here you are in the East End of London. What's your view?
I think it's not going to change as much as we'd like it to change. As long as you've got owners and investors of the businesses looking at short-term gains and short-term profits, nothing will change. You know, you can talk about brands, you can talk about agencies, you can talk about this, this and that. At the end of the day, that all comes down from the investors. So if you've got people that invest in your business and they want to make a lot of money very quickly and then exit within 5 years, nothing will change because that's all driven by profits at the end of the day. So when you look to partner up with hotels, travel agents, whoever it is in the industry, look at who they are, what are they trying to do, what the goals are. That's my advice, really. And that's how you drive the change.
Kevin.
Aside from the need for structural change, the kind of thing that just mentioned there, like, and get private equity out of the industry, which is not going to happen anytime soon. Besides structural change, then the kind of mid-step is going to have to be hotel managers, whoever that company is saying to their contractors, we're now going to offer contracts at the London Living Wage, and we want you to build in training development that as well. So if you've got London Living Wage and training development, straight away employment becomes much more attractive, not only to the people in the industry, but also people outside. So that's the way. That's a progressive step to make. And again, we as a union have been saying that for 14 years, and we're waiting for the industry to talk to us.
Patrick, come on, cheer us up.
Difficult, really. There isn't the leadership in tourism to help improve the reputation as far as employment goes. And I actually think we are on a precipice with Brexit. I think we are, over the next 12 months, we're going to be faced, well, next 3 months, actually, we're going to be faced with huge problems with short-term recruitment. And my children, when they were at school, and they've all left now, but none of the careers advisors at school, and they were in state sector, none of the careers advisors talked about tourism as a profession. Tourism was basically cleaning. It was what you did if you couldn't do anything else. And that's desperately sad, because we aren't going to get good... We aren't going to improve our reputation if we aren't getting good people in, and if we aren't getting into schools. And that's the problem, Harold. I know we've run out of time. I will tell you that I didn't eat when my kids were going through school. I tried to get people coming on work experience, and they didn't even want to refer, knowing who I was with kids in the school. They just weren't referring the children to me for work experience. Desperately sad.
We have run out of time, but there will be another WTM Responsible Tourism program next year. We're certainly going to. It's a really great idea. We will look at what the industry needs to do to have a workforce, and I tend to share Patrick's view. I suspect we're going to see massive change in this if we do Brexit. A lot of people are going to wake up and worry about where they're going to get a labour force from. You only have to walk around this block to see the kinds of hand-to-mouth businesses which, if they have to pay proper wages because that migrant labour chooses to go home, because actually they get paid better at home than they do here, those businesses are going to close. And I think we will see quite a big shake-up as a result of Brexit. Thank you very much indeed. If you would thank the panellists in the usual way, particularly Madhu, I think, for being brave enough to be here. But if you would thank them, I'd be grateful. When you've done that, if you could, if you want to talk to them, meet them over on the side. We've got another panel about to start on Indigenous tourism. But thank you very much indeed.